This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Arts funding in Charlotte flourished prior to the recession, but even then, cracks were beginning to appear. Once the recession hit, giving to the arts fell off a cliff and has never really recovered. We take a closer look at efforts to reverse this and save what Charlotte has built in the process. That's later in the program. First, we meet Vienna Tang. Her harbor is music. A pianist, singer, songwriter, she released her first album in 2002 and shortly thereafter received national exposure on NPR's Weekend Edition. That was followed by an appearance on David Letterman and appearances with a litany of big names in the music business. But she left that harbor for a while to get an MBA and an MS, not in music, from the University of Michigan. Now her voyage is over and Vienna Tang has returned to her musical harbor, all these illusions, and is about to release a new album. She's also in town to perform at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater tomorrow night at 8, and she joins us now. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. You know, you have an interesting background. You started making it into the national spotlight when? In your 20s, I guess?
Yeah, my early 20s. I got really lucky.
And then you announced that the career change, that you were going to go back to school and get an MBA and an MS to study something completely unrelated to music. Why? Because you were just breaking out. Why?
I feel like I have what I call long-term ADD. And so before I went into music, it really is true. It goes in like these sort of five-year spurts. So before I was in music, I was studying computer science.
Yeah.
And that's what I did my undergrad degree in and worked in Silicon Valley for a while. But then I moved on to music and totally fell in love with that. But I felt like the entire time I knew that music wasn't going to be my career my whole life and that there were other things that I would move on to and get passionate about.
You know, people would give their eye teeth to be on Letterman and to be featured on NPR and work with some of the people that you've worked with. And yet you're saying you knew it wouldn't be your career your whole life. It would seem to me if you got to that point, you'd try to make it. You try to stay there.
Oh, and I really did. And, you know, after I got to play on Letterman, after NPR, of course, I continued to tour and put out albums. And I loved that life. It was amazing. Uh-huh. And continues to be amazing because it's still a big part of my life. But I also am one of those artists where I really have to feed my creativity from somewhere else. And I found that traveling around and staying in hotels and just sort of like hang out with musicians all the time, for some people can be really inspiring, but for me, I'm too much of a nerd maybe, or a geek, and I like to explore other things. And I got very interested in sustainability even before I started touring, and finally realized that, you know, I have to go to school for this. I have to learn more about it and get involved in it.
I want to talk about that, but you went to school for sustainability. Before that, you were a computer science major, and you were a computer engineer at Cisco Systems for a couple of years, and you started playing piano at the age of 5. So all of these things, is there a thread that runs through them?
That's a great question. I feel like I feel a real kindred spirit relationship with some things like This American Life, you know, the radio program, where they have a certain format through which they explore things, but at this point they explore any topic, really. And maybe your show is similar like this with news shows, that there's a certain format but a certain just like general curiosity about the world. And I feel like I explore that through music, but I also explore it through technology and now through graduate school and that sort of thing.
I think there is a thread that runs through music and computers. I don't know what it is. I don't know why there seems to be people who are interested in music seem to be pretty good at computers because they're pretty good at math, because it takes math skills to do music well. You don't think about numbers when you're doing it necessarily, but you know, you're thinking about slivers of beats, which are broken up mathematically to create rhythms.
That's true. I think there's a certain amount, and this is true in sustainability studies as well, that you kind of have to get very, very micro detail oriented and keep the big picture in mind at the same time. Like, you can't do it well unless you're doing both at the same time. And I find with songwriting and recording production, that's absolutely true. You get into like these tiny little details of, oh, is this, you know, EQ'd correctly, or is this syllable sitting where it needs to? But you also have to the entire time figure out, like, is this going to have an emotional connection with a listener? And similarly with sustainability, you can talk about, you know, the switching out CFL, you know, for CFL light bulbs or, you know, whatever it is. But you also have to figure out, like, this problem of climate change, this question of climate change, how are we going to solve it? So it's, you know, 10,000 feet and down in the weeds all at the same time.
You have to have an analytical mind. I know that you read a lot of poetry, and obviously you're a lyricist, and that is modern poetry, because most people don't read poetry today. They hear it, they listen to it, they enjoy it, but they enjoy it through music. And that's all about rhythm.
Right.
It's all about the big picture, what the story is you're trying to say, using the words and the rhymes and the rhythms. But then you have to put the words and the rhymes and the syllables, rather, in the right place in the scan. So it will, in the meter, I'm not using the words right, but it has to scan right.
Right. You sound like you've written some lyrics in your time.
Yeah. But they're throwaway lyrics. Not like yours, which have meaning and depth.
Well, lyrics are really hard. They're the hardest part of songwriting for me. But they were a real joy to work on, especially for my new album, because the new album was actually inspired in no small part by hip-hop. I finally got into hip-hop very late in life and got completely obsessed with this idea of flow and how you can cram a lot of dense information into a short space, but also, you know, have a lot of swagger and a lot of groove to it. And so it's really hard to do, but it's so much fun.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's hear a little bit of that hip-hop influence right now. This is a song called In the 99 from your newest album, which will come out in September. Let's listen to this for a minute or two here. A lot of words.
Well, especially when you write music first. So I had that little melody. I was just I'm like, okay, so somewhere there's going to be actual words that fit in this very rapid fire thing I seem to have come up with.
Yeah. And it's hard. You have to. It's like Shakespeare. Rap. Listening to rap for me, at least, is like listening to Shakespeare. It takes your ear a few minutes to adjust to the rhythms, the language, and then when you finally adjust it, it kind of washes into you. It washes over you at first, and then it penetrates.
Right, and that took some understanding for me. It's like, okay, if people are going to absorb this, they absorb it kind of as a sound first, and only later maybe will the meaning of what I'm saying actually hit, and so I have to figure out how I'm going to tell this story in a way that actually hits in the right way.
You're asking the question, were you ever in the 99 in, at that point in the song? The 99, does that refer to the Occupy movement?
Right, yeah, that was definitely where this song began. I had gotten some friends together that I'd met, you know, on the road and through music, and we were just sitting around talking about lots of different topics, and one of them was the Occupy movement, and I didn't want to write a song that kind of took sides, But, you know, I was in an MBA program at the time, and there were a lot of people who fancied themselves part of the 1% or aspiring to the 1%. Mm-hmm. And we would just start talking about, like, well, what does a compassionate investment banker look like? You know, if someone's actually, you know, in his fancy corner office looking down at this protest and sort of thinking about, well, what is my role in this, and, like, am I connected to these people? So that's sort of where that story began.
This is – it's interesting to me because the life of a musician is not necessarily a lucrative one unless you're really, really lucky and very successful, and you were on that track. And then you go back to school to get an MBA. But you seem to have – your lyrics demonstrate a social conscience. And you say that for you, success – has to do with making a real, tangible contribution to society and the environment that you live in to leave it better than when you came in. Some would say, some would argue, that writing the kind of music that you write with the messages in the songs that you sing and being successful at getting that music out and having people listen is not only success, but it is making a contribution and leaving the world better than you found it.
Well, that's certainly the hope, but there's also days that I wake up and wonder if that's just a very presumptuous way to think about music.
Well, I don't know. I think Bob Dylan was pretty successful at changing the way people thought about a lot of things.
Absolutely. And that is my aspiration for sure. I should just put out there that I'm pretty ambitious about what I would like my music to do, and that's why I write about the things I write about, because they interest me. I feel like I want to write songs that are part of a larger conversation about what we want to be as a society, how we want to behave.
So what brought you back to music? I mean, you spent all this time and effort to get the MBA and the MS in sustainability. Why come back to music?
I think in a way because I knew that I was never leaving music permanently. I like to say that, you know, music and I had a, you know, this deep relationship, and then it let me see other people for a while. And so I think that, you know, I'm going to continue.
I just got that.
Yeah, so you know, music and I are in this sort of weird polyamory thing, maybe. But I do feel like music will continue to play a big role in my life and in the way that I engage with the world, and that's important to me. But I also know that I want to devote a lot of my energy from here on out just actually going to work and working on problems and not just writing about them.
You started playing piano at 5. You started writing music, I'm told, at 6. Do you have any of those songs still that you wrote at 6?
Oh, I do, but they might be blackmail material.
Because I think your whole philosophy is, I'm going to try something. If it works, great. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And that's kind of how you approached it at 6, and that's how you approach it today. You really haven't changed your mindset. It opens you to be able to be creative.
Absolutely. At my best, I feel like I go back to my 5 or 6-year-old self, where I'm just messing around and stumbling upon things that I find fascinating and really fun, and wanting to do it as well as I can and to keep practicing until I get the hang of it, and then I can do something with it. And it's funny that you bring that up, because the first song I ever wrote with lyrics was called Curiosity, and it was this grandiose pop song about how, you know, civilization is built on curiosity, and if they weren't inquisitive and didn't ask questions, then where would we be? And so on some level, I'm still writing that song over and over and over again.
How old were you then?
I think I was 10 or 11.
Do you like the song? Or are you embarrassed by it?
I wouldn't write it the same way today. Okay. But I guess for a 10-year-old, it was all right.
Vienna Tang is our guest. We're going to come right back and hear more of her music as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth and engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. The role of fathers in the lives of their children has been changing from one of distance and discipline to that of caregiver and a source of affection and support. At least that's where fatherhood seems to be heading, but Dr. Jeffrey Shears set out to see if that was true. And he recently completed a study and a summit on fatherhood. He found out some fascinating and sometimes sobering things, and we will join him and others Monday at 9 to explore those discoveries. Hope you will too. Thank you.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The Senate makes a deal on filibusters. Attorney General Holder attacks Stand Your Ground laws. And a Rolling Stone cover of the Boston bombing suspect sparks outrage.
Those topics on the Ian Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Vienna Teng, singer-songwriter, pianist. She's playing tomorrow night, Saturday, at 8 p.m. at the McGlohan Theater here in Spirit Square, and she's our guest. You can get tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Let's hear another piece of music that she wrote called Antebellum.
In the fall, we circle through the leaves and talk about the little ones. We smile, but never say too much. The moment always vanishing. One by one, the neighbors' lights come on. Our October day is almost gone. I know the border lines are drew between us. Keep the weapons down.
I wanted to play this here after In the 99 to give people an idea of the breadth of the kinds of styles of music that you deal with. Now, this is from an earlier album called Inland Territory. I'm not sure when that came out.
2009.
Okay, so it's a couple of years. It's just before you went back to school.
Then. Right.
There's a great line that we just heard before I started talking and messed it all up. Our antebellum innocence was never meant to see the light of our armistice day. Wow. What a great line.
I co-wrote that with the producer of this album, Inland Territory, my friend Alex Wong, who's actually performing tomorrow night as well.
Okay.
He's opening the show, and then we're sort of guests on each other's sets, and we're dear friends. And we wrote this song together, ironically, about, two people who have trouble relating to each other and realizing that they cause each other so much pain that they have to go their separate ways.
Maybe this is why I told you off the air that this song reminds me, for some reason, and I don't know why, of Jason Robert Brown, who is a Broadway composer wrote Parade and who wrote The Last 5 Years. The Last 5 Years is about two people who love each other and who can't connect.
Mm.
And maybe that's why it reminds me. I don't know. Why the name Antebellum for this?
Well, we were trying to write a song that was about a very, intimate and personal relationship, but it also felt like, sometimes these emotions unfold on such an epic scale, in your own head and in your own heart, that it felt like, war was an apt metaphor for that. And so we started thinking about, the Civil War and about, the whole notion of an antebellum age that you can never go back to. And then that kind of informed a lot of the music, too, which is why we have these sort of, like, marching snares and this, swelling string orchestra and all of that.
Seasons keep on marching. I'll stay here. You'll go home with only strangers watching.
A lot of the music that I listened to yesterday, comes from your future album that's coming out September 24th, I think, and the previous albums, which is this is one of them, is that the music is really lush and modern in one way, but old-fashioned in another, because you don't hear all these strings, and you're the piano player on this, but you don't hear all these strings and horns. It's very expensive to do that. How do you get away with it?
Well, for this new album, there's an easy answer to that, and the answer is technology.
Synthesizers.
Right. Not only synthesizers, but samplers. There are these amazing sample libraries that I actually intend to credit on the album, because a lot of the horns that you hear, a lot of the symphonic instruments you'll hear on our album, some of them are played by live musicians, but a lot of them actually come from sound libraries where they got, you know, the London Symphony Orchestra to play notes, you know, or phrases, and then you can just, you know, take them.
Yeah. See, is that where your computer programming knowledge comes in as well?
Not mine. This was more producer Kaysen Cooley just knowing, you know,
how
that it's a wise thing to buy these libraries, and then you have a whole orchestra at your disposal.
That's amazing. You said that I want to get back to this. I'm fascinated by this idea that you would leave all this behind and go into sustainability and then come back to music. And you did say that you found at times studying climate change and sustainable ways to live in this world was emotionally debilitating, that it's hard to stare straight at the facts and think, I don't know how we can solve this or even how much we care to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the first year where I was mostly in the environmental school in my program was a really amazing year for me, but also a really hard one, because I felt like, you know, the climate changes and a lot of environmental issues are hard because the enemy is actually not some company and it's not some, you know, evil entity out there.
But
it's the fact that we like the things that we like.
Yeah. It's Pogo. Did you ever read Pogo?
Yes, we've met the enemy.
And he is us.
Yes.
You are a Taiwanese American who grew up in California and started playing classical music at 5. So who were your musical influences? What was playing around the house when you were a kid?
Well, I realize in retrospect that although my parents didn't ever imagine I would become a musician, they set me up pretty well because they had good taste. So they listened to a fair amount of classical music, especially orchestral music, and then they also played a lot of Simon and Garfunkel and Ray Charles and Peter, Paul, and Mary around the house.
Yeah.
My dad was a huge Bob Dylan fan, but as a songwriter, and so he liked to hear Bob Dylan songs covered by other people.
Other people. I can understand that.
Yeah. and so that was actually how my parents learned a lot of English when they were in Taiwan, was by listening to these folk artists from the 70s. And so that's what I grew up with. And Paul Simon was really the first songwriter that I really fell in love with and felt like, this is a sort of thing that I really want to learn how to
Why?
Do.
Why Paul Simon?
Because he had this wide range of styles that he drew from. He could do kind of doo-wop, but he could also do kind of rock and roll. And then he ventured off into experimenting with, you know, South African township music and Brazilian music.
But he was able to do that after he had become a big star.
Right.
Because usually you get buttonholed, and particularly when you're coming up, it seems to me, they find a producer or a record company finds the sound that you are associated with, and that's what you're going to do, because that's what sold the last 5 records. You're not at that stage yet, but you've been able to do that. How?
I think it's the freedom of becoming an artist when I did. It was in the age of MP3s and the internet and sort of the slow implosion of the music industry as we knew it. And so for me, it was an amazing opportunity because I could just do whatever I wanted because there was no playbook at that point. And in a way, it was a blessing that I did get some wonderful attention, but in a way, no one was really caring what I was up to. And so I just had the ability to make the music I wanted to make.
I want to play another example of your music here, it's not only an example of your music, but it's an example of how far afield you can go from cut to cut, from album to album. And this is a song that I just fell in love with yesterday, and we're going to play all of it. It's you. It's completely you. It's just you. Just your voice. This is all of you. And it is, I think, different from anything else on any of these albums, and it's called, and I want people to see if they can figure out what this song is about. Listen to the words. This is Vienna Tang and the Hymn of Axiom.
Somebody hears you, you know that, you know that. Somebody hears you, you know that inside. Someone is learning the colors. understood. Here you're known. Leave your life open. You don't have to leave your life open. You don't have to hide. Someone is gathering every crumb you drop. Decisions and moments you
Vienna Tang, what a wonderful piece of music.
Thank you.
Oh, my God.
It was really satisfying to write. Songs are not always this straightforward or easy, but that song, as soon as I started working on it, I felt sure of what I wanted it to be, and it just sort of unfolded for me in this very smooth way.
And harmonically, just lush.
I had been obsessing over this one choral composer, Morten Lauritzen, who has these amazing shifts and harmonies and amazing colors, and the way that he uses the inner voices of his choir are really beautiful. And so I'd just been sitting at the piano with my little vocal harmonizer effects pedal just trying to figure out, like, what is that chord that he's making? And as soon as I figured some of them out, I just stole them and put them in this piece.
When I listened to this yesterday, and I told you this before we started the show, I listened to it a couple times, because the first time I thought, this is interesting. This is weird. You don't hear this on the radio anywhere. And then I listened to it again, and I thought, it's beautiful. And then I listened to it again, and I thought, what is this about? Listen to the words. I hope people figured this out, and I feel very proud of myself that I did. Although I had to have Google's help to help me a little bit, because I thought, she's talking about databases in this song, and she spells the word axiom. It's called the Hymn of Axiom. She spells it A-C-X-I-O-M. That's not how you spell that word. And I looked it up on Google, and they are a major database company that mines what we do on the internet for marketing purposes. And what are you saying here?
Well, this began with I was writing the slow, sweet song that began with "Somebody hears you, you know that," and it was the sort of comforting sound. But it also there was something creepy about that lyric, you know, that I first came up with. Somebody hears you and you know that, and like, okay, well, this sounds almost like surveillance. And the minute I had that thought, I'm like, oh, well. I had just been doing the summer internship where a couple of my coworkers had access to an Axiom database, and they had been looking up people they knew in this database and realizing how much of their, you know, of everyone's personal life had been captured in there. And so I really wanted to write a piece that was both beautiful and kind of celebrating all the amazing things that come out of companies having all this information, but also, you know, to sound really creepy and unsettling, because I think both of those things are, you know, we experience those simultaneously. Like, we love the fact that our smartphones can look up anything for us because it knows exactly where we are and maybe even knows kind of what we like.
It does. No, it does.
But at the same time, you know, we know that there are these, you know, vast troves of information about us being stored somewhere and used for what? We're not entirely sure. And I know that I'm as guilty as anyone of clicking, you know, terms of service without reading them. And so it felt like a song that could be both emotionally resonant with people as well as part of a larger policy conversation.
If I understood it correctly, there's a lyric in there that says, essentially, open yourself up to this. Is that what you're saying in there at some point? Relax, let it go?
Right. And I also wanted to draw on, you know, sort of sacred-sounding choral music for it, because I feel like a lot of people on some level want to be understood, even if it's by a machine or even if it's by an advertising company.
Is this the new God? God knows everything about us, theoretically speaking. So since these databases know everything about us, is this the new religion?
That's not for me to answer, but it certainly feels like it substitutes for it in some very interesting and maybe disturbing ways.
You say that we want to be known. Do you want to be known?
I do feel like I'm part of a generation that doesn't mind being known, that I feel like the trade-offs for me feel worth it for now, and that there is something, especially, you know, as a songwriter who's trying to, you know, promote myself, it's great that, you know, that people collect information about me. And know that,
well, yeah, they can go on the internet right now and type in Vienna Tang, which I wanted to talk about your name, but we won't. and not only will you pop up, but people can sample your music, which is a great thing.
Exactly. And you can go, you know, way far back and know, you know, where I was playing on October 12th of, you know, 2004 or whatever it was. And there's a record of all of that. And I find that really useful, even though I find it also occasionally worrisome. It's like, wow, there's a lot of info about me out there that whether I like it or not, it's now a matter of public record.
Yeah. I know you've taken these little detours away from music. Is that over? Is this the path? Or will you detour again if the mood strikes?
I never know what the future holds, but at least for the next 5 to 10 years, I know what I'm doing.
Vienna Tang, we know what she's doing tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. She's playing at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater here in the building, and it's a great venue for music. I don't know if you've seen it yet or not, but it's spectacular, and fits your music. So enjoy yourself tomorrow night. I know the audience will. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mike. This has been great.
Never have you felt so close to home.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CPCC Summer Theater, bringing the Broadway smash hit musical Monty Python's Spamalot to the Halton Theater now through the 27th. Tickets at tix.cpcc.edu. Well, the panel of journalists joins Diane Rehm for the week's top national news stories because it's Friday. We do this every Friday. The Senate makes a deal on filibusters. Attorney General Eric Holder attacks Stand Your Ground laws. And a Rolling Stone cover of the Boston bombing suspect has sparked outrage. Those are just a few of the stories that they will talk about in the next 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will be talking about both the airport battle, the battle over the airport, and arts funding in Charlotte when we come back. Stay with us.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it. Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Arts groups almost always struggle due to lack of sufficient funding, and even though people who attend concerts, plays, and who take advantage of other arts offerings may pay to get in, they really don't understand that the price of admission doesn't come close to covering the costs. In years past, Charlotte has been quite successful in filling that gap by funding the arts through a kind of United Way campaign under the auspices of the Arts and Science Council. But in recent years, that campaign has fallen on hard times, leaving arts groups to face funding shortfalls. And all of this and more has been the subject of a series of reports by WFAE's Julie Rose and WFAE's Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance reporter Brianna Duggan. And they join us to expand on what they've discovered in this segment of the program. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good.
Before we talk about that, however, we must talk about another story, Julie, that you have been covering extensively since it began breaking yesterday afternoon and last night, and that is the battle over the airport. The legislature voted yesterday to hand it over to the control of an authority. The city went to court immediately, and then something puzzling happened with Jerry Orr. Talk us through that.
Yeah, well, he was either fired or he quit, one or the other, depending on who you talk to. What happened was that this airport authority measure was written to take effect immediately. So as soon as it was signed yesterday by the lawmakers, the bill stipulates that the airport is effectively no longer under control of the city. It's under the control of the airport authority.
Mm-hmm. But the authority doesn't
which
exist.
Doesn't technically exist, but the airport director immediately becomes the airport authority, the city's aviation director, Jerry Orr. It's written into the bill that he becomes the executive director of the airport authority and is no longer the city's aviation director. And the bill also says that in order to ensure a seamless transition, that the city will basically guarantee to continue to offer all of the services that it has been offering in terms of, you know, there's some police officers out there and finance and HR and all those things sort of during this transition that they'll work closely with the airport authority to kind of ensure all of this. So at the same time that the city was off getting its temporary restraining order to stop this transfer, Jerry Orr, as he believes and his attorneys believe, was required to do by the legislation, sent a letter to the city manager that said, you know, they've and I've seen this letter, I've got it right in front of me. It says, I'm requesting provision of city services for the airport. It says, hey, Mr. Carley, this bill has been passed. You know, and let me summarize what it says, that we're now in charge and I'm now in charge of the airport. I'm asking that you do as the bill says, which is to continue to provide these various services right to the airport so we can stay functioning. And oh, by the way, as stipulated in the bill, you know, since it became effective, I am no longer an employee of the city. That employment has been terminated. Now I'm with the airport authority. Well, he clearly was not intending to resign, but the city attorney and the city manager have interpreted it as, okay, your employment has been terminated, in your own words. Great. See you later. We are going to put your CFO in instead, Brent Cagle. Thanks for all the good times.
Now, surely this could not have come as a surprise to any of the parties involved. This has been going on for months. The
right
city is clearly—
And it's not been pretty. I mean, there's—
No, the city is clearly against this.
Jerry Orr has clearly been for the airport authority. He's
yes
kind of been a pain in their side, frankly.
And the Mecklenburg city County delegation to the legislature, which is pushing this measure, particularly the Republicans on this, Bob Ruscio and Ruth Samuelson and others— clearly know there is friction here, and they clearly must have known that there would be an attempt to stave this off. All parties are saying that it's critical that we maintain stability at the airport, particularly at a time when U.S. Airways is about to merge possibly with American Airlines, and that puts their whole hub system into question. Why would all these people do this and be shooting themselves in the feet, essentially? All parties shooting
yeah
themselves in the feet.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are asking themselves. I mean, clearly this has become a partisan issue. I mean, the votes in Raleigh all went down party lines these last couple of weeks. Republicans supporting the authority, Democrats against it. You know, the city council and the mayor have always maintained that absolutely no way, that their ideal scenario and the best thing for the airport is for the city to maintain control of it, mm-hmm, not an airport authority. The lawmakers were dug in about it being the other side. You know, this is a situation now where the city is saying, we believe that enacting this legislation is going to cause this airport to immediately, this is what they're saying in their argument, immediately lose its credit rating, default on its bonds, that it's going to actually have to shut down because the FAA has not granted the Charlotte Regional Airport Authority a permit. The city has that permit. So technically, you got to close the doors. Like, they say that the very worst case scenario, there's no possibility of cooperation here. We need to stop this immediately. That's
the,
their argument.
Is the FAA under the supervision of the Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox?
Yes.
So he could get involved in this as well.
Sure.
So what happens next?
Well, what happens right now is that the courts have to figure out if the – I mean, for the moment, Jerry Orr is not the director of the airport because it's still a city department, because the judge has got this temporary order which lasts for at least – for a maximum of 10 days. So sometime in the next 10 days, they're going to have to actually rule on the injunctive component of it, and then there will be more court discussion. And then at some point, either the city keeps the airport or the airport authority gets the airport. And if the airport authority gets the airport, then Jerry Orr probably comes back.
Okay. Well, we had Julie here today along with Brianna Duggan to talk about something else entirely, but we wanted to make sure we had our finger on the pulse of the airport situation, because that is a critical thing that's about to take place here, and we don't know how it's going to turn out, quite frankly.
I should just mention, though, that you can still go to the airport if you have a flight today. You can fly. Travelers, the airlines, I mean, at this point, you know, there's you probably will not notice anything different out there.
Okay. So you just – the two of you, Brianna and Julie, you just did a series of reports called about arts funding troubles in Charlotte. What made you interested in this topic? You are arts reporter, so I'll start with you, Brianna.
Right. I mean, we found out that there was this cultural life task force that was meeting to address the arts funding issues in Charlotte. And, you know, over time we had seen that, you know, the symphony, for example, has been running a deficit for 10 years. You know, we've got this big cultural campus that, you know, everything is kind of up in the air at the moment in arts in Charlotte. And so we figured, well, let's see what's going on, you know, let's see what's going to happen. Well,
and you know, when they form this task force, I mean, that happens all the time. Usually it's like, okay, another task force, great. But then you actually, I mean, the words that they're using are pretty dramatic. I mean, the decline, if you look at the numbers, the decline in giving to the Arts and Science Council, and you start digging into some of the finances, we were surprised at how sort of, I think everyone, we sort of have the impression, and they've given the impression for a number of reasons, that things are okay, but really it's not that great.
Let's back up, because at one point the Arts and Science Council, which is the United Way of arts giving, and it used to be tied to the big companies that would do the fund drive. I actually produced this for Jefferson Pilot Broadcasting at one point. They would go so far as to produce a fund drive internally at each of these places, and not unlike the United Way, they'd hand out pledge cards to the employees and they would deduct it from your salary.
They still do that.
Mm-hmm. And that was very successful. And for prior to the recession, I think we were like the number two or three ranked city in the country in terms of the money given to the arts through this process. Then the recession hit, and so everywhere around the country, arts giving fell off because everybody was suffering. But coming out of the recession, is it not reviving?
No, it's kind of stable.
And what did you find out as to why that might be?
Well, you know, Charlotte is a different city than it was when these workplace giving, as they're called, campaigns kind of were set in place. You know, when they came about, Charlotte was, you know, the place for major corporations like Bank of America and, you know, First Union at the time. And so, you know, Charlotte was their main focus. And now these companies are global. They can't just focus on Charlotte. They have a lot of different, you know, places that they have to consider. And kind of the recession brought that about. But that had been going on for a long time. It was
And the other thing, though, to mention, sorry, Mike, is okay. that workplace giving, that employees are less interested in giving to workplace giving. I mean, not only
Why?
Are the numbers
Why
going down, but like the number of actual people giving to these workplace giving campaigns have cut in half.
And is that is the same true with giving to the United Way and to other workplace giving opportunities, or is it just the Arts and Science Council, or do you know?
Study that the Foundation for the Carolinas did, I think, focused primarily on arts giving.
Okay, mm-hmm. So we don't really know.
But we do know that in general, people have felt, I'm sure you saw it inside these workplace giving campaigns, there's a certain amount of peer pressure that can sometimes even go beyond that to sort of coercion And you know, I know people who work in companies where these workplace giving campaigns exist, and they feel like they're being forced to give, and it gives right. them a bad taste in their mouth. And the final component that has been a problem here is that the Arts and Science Council, as a broker, is very efficient in terms of helping the companies to have, be able to give easily through this thing. And, you know, we don't have to deal with 500 different arts groups coming in trying to do campaigns in our workplace and so forth. But it also creates a little bit of a barrier in terms of employees and all these newcomers to Charlotte feeling connected to the arts groups themselves in
because
Charlotte.
Because arts is an umbrella. And you may be a music lover and love classical music and love the symphony right. and love the opera and not care a hoot about theater or the art galleries downtown. And the reverse could be true. And what you have reported in these series of stories is that giving through the Arts and Science Council through all these years, because you didn't give to your favorite organization, you gave to the arts and the umbrella organization, mm-hmm. the organizations themselves could not build up any kind of rapport among their
right,
donors.
Right, personal relationship, yeah.
Did they know that when it was going on, or is this a new discovery now that the money has fallen off and they're trying to go in there and get it themselves?
I think they all will admit that they're a little behind on this. Like, it would have been nice to have really been thinking about this 5-10 years ago. So they're playing catch up, absolutely. They all will say, look, we have not done enough to connect with our donors and really cultivate our own major donors.
But could they have done that really in that heyday period when everybody was giving to the Arts and Science Council? Did they really want to be hit up again for an individual arts group or two?
Yeah, I mean, they were in up until recently prohibited from contacting the same organizations that were funding the Arts and Science Council.
In one of your reports, I don't know whether it was you, Julie, or you, Brianna, that talked to people at the Pops concert at South Park, and you now have to pay to get into that. You didn't used to have
right,
to pay
yeah.
to get into that, but people who were sitting on their blankets on the grass felt that they were supporting these organizations by buying tickets.
Right.
And they had no clue that that doesn't come anywhere near supporting these organizations. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, I think it's a common thought that I support arts by going to them, you know, by clapping in the stands, and that's just quite simply not the case.
Did they think the money was coming from? Did they think the money was coming from their ticket sale, ticket purchase? Did they think it was coming from the ASC, the Arts and Science Council? Did they think it was coming from the government?
Oh.
Yeah, all of them, yeah.
I think one of the things we've heard is that because the Arts and Science Council was such an effective system and machine mm-hmm. that it gave the impression to a lot of people. I heard a lot of nonprofit executives say, yeah, I think the people who come here, they know that on some level the building has been built by the city, or that somehow the city gives to the Arts and Science Council, and people just assume we're like a government run. I mean, a lot of cities do have their arts institutions city funded or almost entirely government funded. And so there's a general assumption that the government's taking care of it. You don't see things shutting down, so people don't think there's a problem. And you haven't had the arts groups themselves really aggressively out trying to reach their donors and their individual, you know, people who come and really pushing for money in the same way that maybe they will be soon. And so there just hasn't been the sense that, you know, that they need anything more from me than the ticket that
I bought
yesterday.
It's also kind of hard to do. If you've plunked down $30 or $40 or whatever it costs to go to see the symphony or Actors Theater or whatever, it's hard to stand in front of people after they bought their ticket and say, we need more of your money
yeah.
to keep this up. It's hard, although it's necessary. What?
For some people, and I think what the arts groups are saying is, well, there's lots of people who maybe could afford 4 or 5 times that. And so those are the ones we'd like to pay more than that, you know.
And perhaps the other part of this that makes this a hidden problem is the fact that we've done remarkable things in the last 10 years with bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
We probably have more theaters, legitimate, state-of-the-art theaters in a 10-square-block area than any place outside of Manhattan. And we certainly have this new art gallery complex down on South Tryon Street. And people look at that and go, wow, the Belk is beautiful, the Booth Playhouse is great, Spirit Square is terrific. Children's Theater is fabulous. Night Theater is wonderful. The Beckler and the Mint, we're doing fine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we're not even doing fine there, are we?
Mm-mm.
Is it all smoke and mirrors?
Well, no. I mean, the buildings are there, and the mortgage is being paid for by revenues from a tax increase that was approved, mm-hmm. and not by voters, but it was passed, and so that's
just the car tax.
It's the rental car tax, yeah. So that. There's not a risk of defaulting at this point that I understand, or even a risk at all of defaulting on the mortgages. The buildings are there. The problem is that we spend a lot of money on the buildings, but what about making sure that those nonprofits inside these beautiful buildings Yes. are sustainable? That's the piece that we're struggling with as a community right now.
And this came up years ago. I brought this up on this program years ago, that we were putting all this money into bricks and mortar and nothing into the programming, which is a cutting off your nose to spite your face, it seemed to me at the time. It still does. The other problem that we have, and particularly the symphony has brought this up, is that we don't have a tradition of arts endowments mm-hmm. in this part of the country, as they do in like Cleveland and the industrial heartland of the country and the Northeast. Where are we in raising endowments that can keep these organizations operating in the bad times?
Well, none of them have the size of endowment that they say they need to really feel good about where they're going and what they need. The symphony has none, basically. The Mint, I mean, everybody is saying they think they need at least twice, if not more, than what they have. And the problem is, and they all say that's the long-term goal because endowments are great. It's easy money in some ways. You can sit back and get the interest payments off that, and you don't have to go out and beg people for that money every year. The problem is that it's really hard to build an endowment when you're trying to just make sure that you can end up in the black every year, if not lose money. And who wants to give a major gift? I mean, endowments aren't built on $50 gifts. They're built on substantially more than that. And it's difficult to pitch to a major donor, especially in an organization like the Symphony. You know, yes, we're struggling to survive and we can't always pay our bills at the end of the month without a loan, but, you know, give to us for this long-term endowment.
So there is this Cultural Life Task Force being formed to study all this. When will they be ready with their recommendations?
Several months, I think, away.
At least, I think, they're talking early next year. They'll have some recommendations.
And they're meeting again, I believe, an open meeting on July the, 29th, I think, when people are invited. But they always have these meetings at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which makes no sense to me either. We're out of time. Thank you for both joining us. Brianna Duggan, our Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance reporter, and Julie Rose, both from WFAE News.